WGTD is supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. Support for WGTD's morning show also comes to you from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. The next installment of PBS's superb documentary series, American Experience, is something particularly fascinating and well worth watching. It is called Edison. And its subject is one of those subjects where all you need really is the last name. And just about everybody in America, and indeed probably in many parts of the world, will very likely know that you're talking about one of the most supremely gifted and innovative inventors in human history, Thomas Alva Edison. Someone who not only deserves credit for what he invented, but also in a sense for reshaping our whole notion of what it means to be an inventor. And he did so by making invention, in a sense, his day job, that which occupied essentially all of his time and energy, and of course to spectacular effect. And the world in which we live to an amazing extent is shaped by this man born in the 19th century. I'm very, very pleased and honored to speak with the woman who was director, writer, and co-producer of this superlative film, Michelle Ferrari. She has written on a dozen previous American Experience films. In fact, won an Emmy for Seabiscuit, as responsible for other such wonderful documentaries as War of the Worlds and Silicon Valley, contributing in various ways. This is her film, and she has a lot to be proud of. Michelle Ferrari, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much, Greg. What lovely things you said about my film.
I really did enjoy it very, very much. Maybe part of the reason is I happen to live in Racine, Wisconsin, which is sometimes called City of Inventors or Invention City, although Thomas Edison has no connection whatsoever with Racine, but we've created a few things ourselves, and so maybe the fact that I live in a city known for inventors and inventions is one reason why I just absolutely loved this film. How much did you know about Thomas Alva Edison heading into this project?
Absolutely nothing beyond what I learned in grade school. This film, like most American Experience films, was commissioned, and I was very excited about the prospect of making it, but I had no preconceived notions about Edison going in. My immediate reaction upon delving into the material was that I was extremely daunted. This is a man who left behind 5 million pages of documents, which a dedicated revolving group of scholars at the Thomas Edison Papers Project at Rutgers University has been working on since 1978 to catalog, publish, digitize, and otherwise make sense of those papers. And at the same time, this is a person who is extraordinarily famous in his lifetime, and as you pointed out, remains so nearly a century after his death. The first full-length biography of Thomas Edison was published when he was 31 years old. In the years since, there have been at least 75 others. One of my interviewees in the film recently estimated that well over 1 million words have been dedicated to the story of Edison's life. And my task was to render that story in 42 pages, which is roughly 15,000 words.
So wow.
It was rather a daunting prospect.
Hmm. One of the things I'm a little bit curious about, and I wish we had all day to talk because I would probably delve into this very deeply, is the fact that it sounds like a primary facet of your work in documentaries has been as a writer. And, of course, a film like Edison, although I very much appreciated the words and how illuminating they were, of course, a documentary film is about a lot more than the words that are spoken. It's also about the images and the shaping of images. Could you just say a quick word about that sort of partnership of image and word, and particularly what that sort of felt like, or how that worked to get those two elements worked together in putting this film specifically together?
Well, it's interesting, you know, because the period of Edison's life where he did his most, arguably his most significant inventing, the phonograph and the electric light, was not well documented archivally. So that was a big challenge for us, and we had to come up with a way of rendering the active process of invention. You know, we had a lot of archival photographs of Edison and his team, but they were posed. You rarely saw them in action, and very rarely even inside the laboratory. They were often out on the steps. So that was a big challenge, and we had to come up with some original cinematography, which I'm very pleased with the way it turned out. Our director of photography, Rafael de la Luz, did a fantastic job. But to give you a sense that something was actually happening, because the stories demanded a feeling of active invention. And then, you know, when you get into the later period of his life, which is much more well documented, the ability to sort of bring words to life, and rather than illustrate, to create an evocative feeling about the period and the man, is just a super exciting process. I love working with editors almost more than any other part of the process.
Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of amazing images that are here, and of course you're right, to an exceptional extent, Edison's later years are well documented, and to some extent, some of that documentation appears to have been done by him. Your film gives us that impression anyway.
Yes, definitely. I mean, he was very aware of his image in the world and was a gifted self-promoter. So, you know, later in his life, when he was working at the West Orange Laboratory, he employed a full-time photographer.
We're speaking with Michelle Ferrari about the American experience film Edison, which explores the incredibly interesting life of Thomas Alva Edison, one of history's greatest and most influential inventors. We are told in the film about the humble beginnings of Thomas Edison and the fact that he received, if I remember correctly, approximately 3 months of formal schooling. I mean, it's hard to fathom that someone who went on to accomplish as much as he did could accomplish what he did with such sparse formal education. Am I remembering that correctly? And how
That's
is such
correct,
a thing
yeah.
possible?
Well, he, you know, his mother had been a school teacher and she homeschooled him to a certain extent. But he later credited her with instilling a great passion for reading. He was an absolutely voracious reader and a dedicated autodidact. So when he wanted to know about something, when he had a curiosity about something, he read like crazy. And that continued throughout his life. So, you know, reading remains a really good way of teaching yourself things. He was just largely self-taught, which is really amazing. And I think part of what made him so appealing to Americans, because he didn't have a fancy educational pedigree that people couldn't relate to.
Something else which, in a sense, also makes him a still more admirable figure than he might otherwise be is the fact that I believe from a relatively early age, Thomas Edison suffered from profound hearing loss. And to some extent, at least in some of the things he did, it seems like he managed to turn that problem actually into something of a strength. Tell us more about that. Just how deaf was Thomas Edison? And at least in certain instances, how was he able to, in a sense, turn that to his own advantage?
You know, it's hard to say how deaf he was. He claims that by the age of 12, he couldn't hear the birds outside. But it's also true that you see him at times interacting in footage, for example, with people, and it seems like he can hear better than that. So it's a bit of a question. One of the scholars I interviewed suggested that perhaps he turned his deafness on and off to a certain extent when he didn't want to participate in things. That being said, he definitely had some significant hearing loss, which was probably the result of a congenital deficiency. But he definitely regarded it as a strength. It gave him, he believed, the ability to focus and think. And he was less inclined to be distracted by the outside world. And he definitely turned that to his advantage. And he, you know, at the Menlo Park Lab, it was a big open space. His desk was against one wall. But he was able to sit at that desk and tune out everything else that was going on in the room. Well, he didn't have to tune it out. He couldn't hear it. So he considered that an advantage.
He was working in this then cutting-edge, splendid technology of the telegraph. And I'm really glad that your film takes at least a couple of minutes to kind of immerse us in that world, because of course now that is a world that is essentially vanished into oblivion for modern Americans, and yet at the time it was an incredibly fertile field, and actually for someone like Thomas Edison, destined to become a great inventor, it was a wonderful field in which to be working. And it's actually there you tell us that he first began to sort of exert his inventive muscles as an inventor. Tell us more about that.
Well, he actually started, I mean, he became fascinated with telegraphy as a boy, and he taught himself Morse code and learned to send and receive telegraph messages and became a telegraph operator when he was 15. And he almost immediately started tinkering with the machinery. He liked a challenge. He was always thinking about the next big thing. So once he'd mastered Morse code and sending and receiving messages, he needed to be on to the next thing. So he started tinkering with the technology and figuring out ways to improve it, and did a lot of sketching in his free time. He worked at night usually because there were fewer distractions and less work to do, and it gave him time to read and experiment. And he just proved really facile with the technology and able to think about, you know, multiple ways of improving it, which made him very valuable to the companies that were vying for control of that industry.
And it was interesting to me, one of the most valuable lessons that it seems to me maybe a would-be entrepreneur might take from this early phase of Edison's career is the fact that I think a lot of people think, I got to think up this spectacularly new idea that no one's ever had before, and maybe that's the pathway to my success and fortune. And in a sense, Edison's first work wasn't really about that at all. It was about taking things that already existed and making them better, fine-tuning them. And that in that process, which on the outside probably looks like a pretty modest undertaking, not the ticket to fame and fortune and success, that's probably where Edison, in a sense, fostered the tools that would serve him so splendidly when it came time to unleash truly innovative ideas on the world.
You know, I think you're absolutely right about that. I would say, actually, I would argue that invention is very rarely, if ever, a bolt out of the blue. It's actually a social process. It's an evolution of ideas, a steady evolution, with each inventor building on the discoveries and conclusions of a person who came before. You know, absolutely no one invents in a vacuum. So if you look actually at the trajectory of Edison's career, he was working on improving technology in almost every instance that actually already existed. I mean, the light bulb was patented 6 years before he was born.
Hmm. But he takes it to the next level.
Exactly.
Hmm. Tell her.
And he excels at that because he is, by nature, very diligent and doesn't give up.
Tell our listeners about his relationship to the telephone. I think for a lot of us, this is a really important facet of Thomas Edison's life and career that a lot of us aren't aware of.
Well, the telephone, when Bell first unveiled it in 1876 at the Philadelphia Exposition, was understandably, I think, even today, related to telegraph technology. It was actually called the talking telegraph. And it was considered sort of the next step in communications technology, as it well proved to be. And so, you know, Edison had contracts with various telegraph manufacturers, and he was asked to look into this new talking telegraph and to figure out how to make it a commercially viable device, because Bell's phone was impressive and awe-inspiring to the people who saw it, but it didn't transmit sound clearly or over long distances. So Edison set to work improving this technology and developed something known as a carbon button transmitter that improved the sound quality and the volume, and those were used in telephones for 100 years.
Hmm. Speaking of awe-inspiring, I think you are, I am so glad that your film does not brush over the development of the phonograph, because that was something that the world had never seen before. And I think something that is so easy to take for granted now. I mean, we all walk around with, you know, multiple recording devices on nearly everything we own. And I think your film does a remarkable job of sort of taking us into that moment in the late 19th century when sound was recorded for the first time, the most ephemeral of what we experience around us, the thing that tends to just be there and then gone, is suddenly not gone anymore at all. I wonder if, as you were working on this particular moment of the film, and in particular as you were writing it, what kinds of things did you think about to help put you in that time and place?
It's an interesting question. You know, I had such great material from my interviewees who were all very enthusiastic about this moment and very good at describing it in an evocative way. And, you know, they kept repeating this phrase about it seeming like magic. And there were all these great anecdotes from the period about people being afraid, you know, now that there was recording technology, about saying things out loud for fear that it would come back to haunt them. You know, there were predictions that politicians would suddenly fall silent. And I think I just spent a lot of time reflecting on the magic quality of it and the way in which it turned people's ideas about what was possible upside down.
Hmm. It's amazing. I mean, and again, in both the sight and the sound, I think you really capture the magic of that moment brilliantly well.
Thank you.
Of course, Thomas Edison turns his attention. He is not content to rest on his laurels, far from it. And he ends up, of course, unveiling what is the first commercially viable electric light. One of the things I learned from your film is that, and you've already touched on this briefly, the fact that he didn't invent the light bulb. There already was such a thing. But there wasn't anything that really could be used by ordinary people. Explain the breakthrough that for which Thomas Edison deserves credit.
I'm going to do the layman's explanation. There's, of course,
perfect,
a very complex scientific explanation, which I don't think I could render, especially at this hour in the morning.
Right.
But, you know, essentially, the big challenge of the incandescent light bulb was to find a material that would incandesce without burning up. And at the point that Edison took on this challenge, no one had been able to do that. People had invented light bulbs that lasted for 20 seconds or 30 seconds, but not that would burn and burn and burn. So he actually had a very good understanding of electrical laws. He had read widely, he read Faraday, and he understood that he needed a material with a certain amount of electrical resistance. And he did a vast amount of calculating and went down many wrong paths and ultimately figured out that he needed a combination of a vacuum bulb and a carbon filament. And people had been using carbon long before Edison, but they hadn't figured out that they needed this vacuum bulb, and he managed to develop one that was superior to any other that had been ever produced. And the combination made for a long-lasting bulb.
And, of course, this changes everything. And one of the things I especially found interesting was how you tell us about that slow process of Edison trying to, in a sense, illuminate all of southern Manhattan?
Yes.
And how there would be these isolated pockets of wealthy people who would not want to wait and who would want that technology of the electric light brought into their homes. And so you have piecemeal this springing up, but that was not what Edison's vision was. He was determined to achieve something else, which was far harder to achieve.
That's correct, yeah. The isolated plants, these sort of individually run, each with its own generator systems that were put into wealthy people's homes, and also on, you know, ships and in various offices and so on and so forth. It was a real moneymaker for the company, for Edison's company, and, you know, he had a lot of investors and they wanted to make their money back, so there was a lot of pressure for him to do that work. But he was really interested in the more democratic process of building these central stations and lighting everybody's homes. But that was a very capital-intensive and labor-intensive endeavor. And in fact, the central stations he was working with DC Power, and the delivery range of DC Power is only about a mile or two. And so, the plan, when you think about it now, was utterly impracticable because there would have had to have been a power station every mile.
Hmm. He, of course, ultimately sort of runs into trouble when it comes to developing something for widespread consumption of the public, as other competitors sort of spring up with this more efficient means of creating electricity, and in other ways too. On the one hand, Edison was this brilliant mind and someone who was all about implementation and making things viable, and on the other hand, he wasn't perfect. And your film takes time to explain some of the ways in which Edison's own hubris maybe got in his own way, or his own sense of not cooperating and sharing. I mean, I suppose at many points during his life and career, he was faced with some vexing choices.
Absolutely. I mean, I think when I'm guessing that you're talking about the AC/DC Battle of the Currents issue. And I think, you know, there were a number of things going on for Edison in that moment. I think the first thing and the most important thing from my perspective is he'd been working on electricity for a very long time at that point. You know, we're talking about the late 1880s. He'd started working on the bulb in the 70s. And he wasn't particularly given to commitment. He really preferred to be moving on to the next big thing. And so the toll that it took to not only create that first electrical power grid, but then to extend the system, not only in the United States, but abroad, I think it wore him down a little bit. And I think he was tired of electricity, number one. Number two, AC power, as someone in the film says, required a degree of mathematical understanding that Edison just didn't have. And I think he wasn't at that point in his life and career willing to put in the time to master it. And then third and finally, he was very competitive, and he wanted to protect his system. And he behaved in, you know, what to our eyes today, especially and even at the time, I think was an irrational manner. But I really do think he was sort of done and he wanted to move on. And it was an act of unconscious self-sabotage.
Interesting. Well, of course, he goes on to other important work, including great work in the whole field of moving pictures. And ultimately, your film tells us, had his name attached to more than 1,000 patents before his retirement in 1926 and his death a few years later. Let's finish quickly by this notion, which I raised in the introduction, of Edison, in a sense, transforming our notion of what an inventor was until Edison came along. And to some extent, we still think of the typical inventor as a tinkerer who does something else during the day, and then at night, while his wife is sewing, he goes out into the workshop and tinkers around with various gadgets and so on. Edison really reshapes the notion of what an inventor was or could be.
Edison is essentially the precursor to the modern R&D lab. What he started at Menlo Park, his first laboratory, was essentially an R&D lab with the idea of, as he put it, you know, churning out a major invention, a minor invention every 10 days and a big thing every month or so. And he approached invention with a team. His method was team research, and he worked with that team closely, oversaw and directed their work, but gave people a lot of freedom within that and a lot of autonomy, and really, you know, established this realm in which coming up with marketable technology was the goal of the day.
It ultimately...
And that was later, you know, repeated and emulated by major research laboratories all over the United States.
He changes everything, including our notion of what a celebrity is. And of course, by the end of his life, as your film rightly points out, Thomas Edison is one of the major celebrities in all the world. And the world in which we live to such a remarkable extent is shaped by his innovations. The film, again, is Edison, the Father of Invention. It is another film in the marvelous PBS series American Experience, and the writer, director, and co-producer of this film, Michelle Ferrari. Michelle Ferrari, congratulations on a superb film. I enjoyed every minute of it, and I enjoyed this opportunity to talk with you about it.
Thank you so much, Greg. It was a pleasure.
You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and classical music on your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. One of the most highly regarded travel experts in the country, Rich Steves, is next. On several occasions, I've had the great pleasure of speaking with one of the best-known authorities in America when it comes to travel, and particularly world travel, and I'm talking about Rick Steves, and I'm sure many of you know him through his publications, through his presence on public television, or both, and I have in hand Rick Steves' Europe Through the Back Door, the Travel Skills Handbook 2015, his most up-to-date guidebook for traveling through Europe and traveling there in the style which he prefers, through the back door. And it is one way in which you can travel Europe a bit less expensively and, more importantly, experiencing Europe in a much richer, deeper, and ultimately more satisfying way. Rick Steves, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you. Nice to be with you. And you summed it up quite nicely there.
And I especially have enjoyed reading this book, as everything else by you that I've read, in particular because the college where I work has the choir touring Spain right now. And so my mind is very much with my voice students that are in Spain right now, though they're about to come home. So
that's so great. So many universities are putting foreign study as part of a well-rounded higher education, and I just think that's a wonderful trend.
Absolutely. I want to ask you a couple of interesting things, about a couple of interesting matters and important matters. One of them, since a lot of your book is around the notion of traveling through Europe without incurring too much expense, is you say flat out, Europe is expensive. You just need to know that right off the bat. How expensive is Europe compared to the rest of the world? I mean, is it one of the most expensive places one can travel right now? Or is it just a little more expensive than what we're used to here in America?
Oh, I would say it depends on the exchange rate. It's generally more expensive than America. But, you know, the euro is down about 20% on the dollar right now from a year ago, I believe. And this is wild how powerful the dollar is right now against the euro. So that softens the blow a little bit. But Europe is a very wealthy and successful part of the world. And it's as successful and expensive and comfortable and affluent as the United States. Mm-hmm. And it's just common sense that if you go to Los Angeles or if you go to Chicago or New York or Tampa, you can know how much you're going to spend when you go there. And, you know, high-rise hotels in Tampa and high-rise hotels in London will be expensive on either side of the Atlantic. The great thing about traveling in Europe is you have alternatives, and you can stay in people's homes. You can enjoy wonderful, innovative ways to sightsee that are, you know, museum passes and hop-on, hop-off bus tours and walking tours. Many of them are free, done by volunteers who are maybe retired teachers and so on that like to just keep active. And for me, one great thing about Europe is that some of the best experiences are absolutely free. Hmm. All over Europe, you've got wonderful free museums. It's kind of funny, depending on the government in some countries, how much their philosophy about museums. If you get a left-wing government, they're going to think, the museum's for the people, and they open up and they're free. And if you get a right-wing government, everything's got to turn a profit, and the museums suddenly have a fee to get in. But across the board in Europe, you'll find that the high culture is something that's very accessible. In Vienna, they make sure that students can afford great live classical music, for example. So everywhere you go, what you need to do, though, is equip yourself with good information so you can expect yourself to travel smart. We Americans have the shortest vacations in the rich world, and we're always complaining about how expensive things are, which I think is kind of funny because we're filthy rich by almost any standard. But, you know, we've got limited travel money, and it's quite a splurge to go to Europe. And if we are using our money smartly and using our time smartly, we'll enjoy maximum fun for every mile, minute, and dollar in our trip.
Before I ask you a couple more things specifically about Europe, I want to explore a few of the basics of just traveling smartly and wisely, which probably are applicable to trips that you might take just about anywhere around the world. One of the most intriguing things about the way you write about this is the balancing act that you think people need to have between careful planning ahead of time versus being a bit spontaneous and flexible. And of course, at a glance, some people might think those two things just don't gel with one another. But of course, in fact, they do. Help us understand how one can and needs to plan ahead in a careful way and yet be spontaneous and flexible.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you can be spontaneous and flexible and in a chaotic mess with your itinerary and the way you use your vacation time. Or you can be spontaneous and flexible and well-organized in the way you use your precious vacation time. I think it's good to have to realize that the planning part of your trip is a fun part of the whole experience. And the more you plan, the more you know what your options are, you know what you want to do. It's so easy to leave a city not realizing that there was a wonderful museum that's just exactly about what you're all about. Maybe if you love pianos, you didn't realize you could go to a museum in Vienna where you could actually see and hear demonstrated the evolution of pianos from the very early clavichords and harpsichords up to the beautiful pianofortes that came after that. It would be a shame to learn about that after you left town. Maybe you're really excited about handbags. Well, there's a handbag museum in Amsterdam that's just wonderful. Maybe you've always been fascinated by leprosy, and you go to Bergen in Norway, and you leave the city, and you realize, oh, that's the city of where Hansen was working on treating leprosy, and there's a museum for the history of treating leprosy right there in Bergen. So all of these amazing sites are out there, and you need to know where they are and incorporate them into your itinerary. I think it makes sense these days to generally make reservations for hotels in advance. So you've got the parameter set, and then you can make reservations for the most efficient and economic transportation connections. But then within the confines of that, or within the template of that, use your free time in a flexible way. To me, that makes a lot of sense. In this day and age, we've got a lot of crowdsourcing, TripAdvisor kind of sites where people are just enamored with this. Oh, what is everybody else doing? What's everybody else saying? I think there's a purpose for that, and it's a valuable service, but we have to be careful to try to curate all that data. If everybody's just throwing around opinions, it's important to have somebody who knows what the options are, who's been there many times, who understands the context of your needs. And that would be what you'd find, I hope, in a good guidebook, and that's what we try to do with all the Rick Steves guidebooks.
And, of course, one of the things you're also trying to help people experience that they otherwise might not is what you at one point describe as this kind of backdoor philosophy or traveling close to the ground. At one point you say connecting with people carbonates your experience. I absolutely love that turn of phrase.
Yeah.
So you're talking about getting off the main drags, off the beaten path, and experiencing, for instance, a place like Europe, in a sense, much more authentically than if you follow the herding masses to all the same tourist traps, so to speak.
Yeah, it's people that really does sort of carbonate your travel experience in so many ways. And if I'm making a TV show or writing a guidebook or leading one of our tours and I'm not connecting people with people, it's really, I'm nervous as a tour guide or a teacher. The mark of a good trip is how many people you meet. And when, in so many ways, a lot of us just see the cultural cliches on stage. Go back to our low-stress, low-risk American-style hotel and talk to other Americans. That's not a very good job of traveling. I just have so much fun. You know, go to the bar or go to the pub in England. It's not like a tavern in the United States. It's the community living room in anywhere in Britain. And if you sit at the table, you'll be given privacy. If you sit at the bar, you will have friends all around you, buying you beers and telling you stories and wanting to hear your story. All across Europe, there are ways to connect with people. And Europeans are fascinated by Americans, and they're inclined to really like Americans. And we have a real advantage that way, and that's what brings back the best memories.
Hmm. We should say that your book outlines an 8-step process for building an itinerary wisely, and I think that in and of itself is an enormous help for any traveler. I wanted to ask you about something that I suspect has been in previous books, but I've never noticed it till I read this particular guide. Again, we're talking about Rick Steves' Europe Through the Back Door, the 2015 edition. You talk at one point about how you typically will purchase several guidebooks for any country to which you are traveling, and you do remind us that it's important to have an updated travel guide. It's so foolish for somebody to spend thousands of dollars on a trip and then use an out-of-date guidebook. But you like to customize your guidebooks. Explain to our listeners what that refers to and why you do it.
Oh, every guidebook has a different personality and a different passion. If they're any good, they're worthwhile. To me, guidebooks are $20 tools for, as you mentioned, $3,000 experiences. And I like to physically rip up the guidebook. I don't want to carry 4 books about Germany to dinner with me in Munich, but I would like the chapters from different books if I'm really, wanting to use that information. Some books are better for helping you understand the history and the art, and others are better for helping you understand the entertainment scene and so on. Of course, these days you can buy your guidebooks electronically also, So if you like to travel with a tablet, that works. But the bottom line is have information and take advantage of it, because there's so many mistakes and pitfalls out there, and there's so many scams that await you, and there's so many delights that can be appreciated or can be missed by determined by how much information you've got and how good it is and how well you use it. I think we're the only people in the publishing business now that endeavor to visit every place every year in person, and our guidebooks are updated lovingly. I work with 100 people here at Rick Steves Europe, and many of us are out there just visiting each of these little B&Bs and taking these hikes and going to these new galleries and museums and sampling all the cultural wonders of Europe, and then bringing it home, because we Americans, again, have the shortest vacation in the rich world. And you don't accomplish anything by saying you can spend a lifetime in Florence. I know you can, but I got 1.5 days. Now how should I use it? And that's my challenge, is to sort through all the superlatives and cut through all the data and let people understand this is how you use your precious vacation time to enjoy one of the great cities on this planet.
Specifically about Europe and this trip that some of my students are on right now, of course, I, along with many of their parents, felt a certain sense of trepidation because of recent events in Europe, and of course, that's kind of a perpetual concern. At one point, when you are talking about travel in general, you say, don't be a creative worrier. What do you mean by that term, being a creative worrier?
Well, a creative worrier, I just remember even when I was a kid, people seemed to sit at home and think about, what can I be stressed about? What could go wrong? It can't be this easy. You know, going to Europe on a road trip is not much different than going around the United States on a road trip. It's just you'll have more diversity and more cultural change and a language barrier to deal with. But, you know, physically, it's about the same thing. In so many ways, Europe is more rewarding to travel because it's different and it's got all that rich culture and all that love of good food and everything. And people might worry about the safety and I just think not so much being a creative warrior, but now these days the issue is don't be manipulated by commercial news media that is actually entertainment masquerading as news. A big change has happened in our society since Walter Cronkite used to say, and that's the way it is. Back then, networks were happy to lose money during the news hour because that was a contribution to our democracy, that networks would provide us news that was straight news. Some time between now and then, we've gotten more aggressive. Corporations have to profit maximize in the short term. And now corporate news media has to turn a profit. And when you have to turn a profit, you have to juice it up and sex it up and bloody it up and make everything a crisis. And I like it. I mean, it's just entertaining. It grabs me. But I don't let it make me a fearful person. There's more fear in our society these days than ever before. When I started traveling, people said, bon voyage. Now they say, have a safe trip. I just don't know what that's all about. You know, if you really understood the risk, you'd realize you're safer going to Europe than you are walking the streets of our country. You know, Europeans laugh out loud when they hear that Americans are staying home for safety reasons. If you knew the statistics as far as violence on the streets and so on, you'd take your kids to Europe tomorrow. But, you know, the bottom line for me is that it is safe to travel. You know, if there's 300 million people in Europe, if somebody is killed in a terrible event in Paris or a handful of people are killed, it doesn't make it any more dangerous than Chicago. In the last year, I've been in Egypt, I've been in Palestine, I've been in Turkey and Russia. A lot of my loved ones might think, Rick, do you think this is safe? And I've never felt that I've been taking any sort of unwise risk. And in fact, I think the irony is if people were so afraid that they stayed home, this world would become a more dangerous place, and the unreasonable fear that they were feeling might sadly become a reasonable fear.
Right.
It is exciting for Americans to get out and better understand the other 96% of humanity, and that's something I love to promote, and I like to promote it in a way that's just fun. Again, we've got 30 different guidebooks covering all of Europe. To me, Europe is the wading pool for world exploration. If your travel dreams are taking you to Europe and you don't have a lot of money, I think it's a good idea to equip yourself with some guidebook that can help you travel like a temporary local person over there, and by all means, make it happen. There's, I take 20,000 people to Europe on 800 different tours a year. We go to Turkey, we go to Russia, we go to Ireland and Paris and Portugal, Morocco, and I've been doing this for 30 years, and you know, we have never been anything but celebrating and thankful for the opportunity to go over there. And it's the fearful people are the ones who don't get out very much. I think fear is really for people who don't get out much.
Right. You make a very important point about how Europe is something, is a, you call it a complex mixed bag of the very old, the very new, and everything in between. And I think you you take the time to say that because it's important for Americans to have some sense of that as they go there. Because you also make the point of Europeans are, in a sense, reaching for their future while these tourists come and are reaching for Europe's past. And so it can make for an interesting situation sometimes.
Oh, it is funny because we want to see people at the well with a jug on their head, you know, and that just makes for a nice photograph. But the young people in Europe, they're going to the big cities so they can be more modern and more international and more, you know, on the edge like we like to be. I think it's just the layers of history in Europe are just so fascinating. You know, in southern Spain, it's not unusual to be in an amazing church that's sitting on the ruin of a destroyed mosque, that's sitting on the rubble of a destroyed church, that was built on the rubble of a destroyed Roman temple, that was probably built on the rubble of a pre-Roman holy ground, and all of that layering is right there. And when we get all excited about some horrible event in our day and age, it's important to remember there's never been a time when there weren't events like this. What's new now is 24/7 news that puts it in our face, and what also is new is an opportunity for us to learn about each other and expect our neighbors to better understand the variety and the diversity on this planet. And for me, when I travel, I'm putting together sort of a collection of different strands of different cultures, and when I come home, that's my favorite souvenir. I can weave different sensibilities and different taste treats and different dimensions of cultures into my culture. I become more thankful than ever that I'm an American, and at the same time, I become a better citizen of the planet, and in a lot of ways, that's the best souvenir. And I am just going to Europe. I've been spending 4 months a year in Europe every year for the last over 30 years now, and it never gets old, and the people I meet are just amazingly warm and welcoming, and the lessons just keep getting better and better, and I'm always amazed about places I discover that I never even knew existed. And all of a sudden, wow, where did this place come from? It's been there all along, and you can just never exhaust Europe of what it has to offer.
Mm. The book is Rick Steves' Europe Through the Back Door, updated for 2015, and further updates available at www.ricksteves.com. The book is full also of photographs and interesting maps and charts. One of my favorite maps lays Europe over the North America, since we're on the same latitude, to give one a sense of, well, if you're in Oslo or if you're in Lisbon, this is sort of what it might sort of feel like. It's just one more way to make Europe a little more approachable for all of us, so we can access all of its wonders. Rick Steves, I thank you so much for all of the great work that you do and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about this and your other books. Best wishes to you.
Thank you very much, and happy travels.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, you'll be hearing from former Kenosha Mayor Patrick Moran, who has written a memoir about his early life, his childhood growing up in North Chicago, through his high school years, college years, and then into the experience of being in the United States Marine Corps during the 1960s, during the Vietnam War. A story of a baby boomer. That will be tomorrow. On Thursday's Morning Show, I'll talk with the author of a new book called Changing the Conversation. Dana Kasperson has done extensive work in the field of conflict resolution, and that's what her new book is about. And on Friday's Morning Show, the first of a two-part interview recorded with Bill Hayes. He was a cast member for Your Show of Shows with that great genius Sid Caesar. He was a lead in the original Broadway cast of Rodgers and Hammerstein's Me and Juliet. And for more than 40 years, In-N-Out has been a cast member in television's perhaps best beloved soap opera, Days of Our Lives. I have an interview with him again that you'll hear Friday and Monday. The Morning Show is supported by Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, a proud supporter of WGTD's Morning Show. WGTD is also supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. Cloudy with light freezing drizzle and fog this morning, but partly sunny by the afternoon with a high of 33. Partly cloudy overnight, low of 17. Partly sunny tomorrow as we warm to 37 degrees. A 50% chance of light rain, sleet, or snow tomorrow. I should say on Thursday. This is WG.